Hello and welcome to Emerge, Evolve, Lead, a podcast for people in recovery from addiction who want to be better leaders. I got clean and sober when I was 24, and then I started my corporate career. After several decades, I left that job and created Emerge Leadership Academy, where I train leaders and coach people in recovery who are ready to step up in their career. My name is Maureen Ross-Jem, and I'll be your host.
My guest today is Morgan Chonis, and she's been sober for over 8 years now, and she really dove headfirst into her recovery. She is a Reiki master and a spiritual guide in helping her clients grow and overcome their past conditioning and trauma. Just recently, Morgan became a published author of her self-help book called Unravel the Bullshit. Welcome to the show, Morgan. How are you?
Thank you so much, Maureen. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to meet you and have you on the podcast today. So why don't you give a little rundown of your what your life is like now? What was your sobriety date? A little bit about your family, what you do for a living, things like that. And then we'll get into your story.
Absolutely. Today, who I am a transformation and embodiment coach. I work with sponsees regularly. I am in a 12-step program. My sobriety date is August 3rd, 2013. So I've got a little over 8 years of sobriety. And what I do for work is I work with people really getting clear on their truth. And that work that we have the privilege to do in program has afforded me this opportunity to now work with others to help them have similar transformations and be able to identify what it is that they would love to do to live their juiciest lives. So whether that's going independent or leaving their corporate job or, you know, turning their side hustle into a main business. I do a lot of business consulting and coaching as well. And the biggest thing that I recently have done was I had been living in Southern California for the last 10 years with some little blips here and there for work elsewhere. And I put my whole life in storage in Huntington Beach. And I said goodbye for now to my community and my people and my West Coast life. And I'm spending some time traveling and getting the book published and really spending some time with my family. I'm in Arizona right now with my family, my mom and my brother. And I'm fully surrendered to wherever the universe is going to take me next, wherever the wind blows.
That is so nice to be able to really just listen to your heart and your intuition and live life fully, full out. That's amazing. Oh, I'm glad you landed in a pretty nice place because I was like, leaving Huntington Beach? What are you, crazy?
I know. I had to get really clear. And, you know, you mentioned like listening to my intuition and following my heart is, it felt insane. Like Huntington Beach was always the end all be all goal for me. And then I woke up and realized that I had ticked all the boxes that I had set for myself in early sobriety. And I was like, well, now what?
Yeah. And that's, you know, where then you got to hit the road. I totally know what you're saying. I got sober in Texas and I moved back to Connecticut for about 2 years into my sobriety. And then about probably 10 years or so into my recovery, my husband and I, we decided, you know what? We got to go. We got the wanderlust. We got to go. We went to Arizona in the middle of August for 3 weeks because we thought we were going to move there. No.
Changed your mind?
Well, I think there's four kinds of people, if you will. This is my little theory. There's beach people, there's city people, there's mountain people, and there's desert people. We are not desert people, period. Right? So that's kind of what we discovered there. But still, we get on the motorcycle and go now. We do have traveled across the country and back to California and back to the East Coast once and to Montana and back the next year. And so we've gone up and down the East Coast. So it's been a really awesome adventure, but we just have our home base here and we travel out to those other places. So good for you for doing that, Morgan. It takes a lot of courage. It really does. All right. So let's get into your story. Let's tell us, you know, what was it like growing up and kind of how were you conditioned and how did you decide to start drinking? And then how did you decide to quit? What happened?
Absolutely. So I was raised and conditioned in a very, in the good girl role. I had an incredibly loving family. My mom is a realtor. My dad owned a restaurant here in town. I have a younger brother, and I was always provided for, in the grand scheme of things and whatever trauma, I like to think that I would have in my life. I had a very privileged life. And I grew up, daddy's girl for sure. And I was an athlete. And so, we had these plans, and I had played soccer since I was five. And I was going to go, I knew where I was going to college. I knew I was going to play for the women's national team and become a professional soccer player. And, all of the things were lined up, right? And so I didn't get into much trouble. I was not a rebel growing up. I really stayed in this mold of this good girl ideology, right? And that's how I got my needs met. It was this react and reward system that, we're so conditioned to. If you're in this good girl or boy model, is you perform well and you get rewarded. And so that's really how my life was growing up. And then when I was in high school, early high school, I broke two vertebrae in my back playing soccer.
Oh boy.
So everything that I had worked for and everything that I knew my purpose to be was shattered. And so at that time, I then went down the road of pharmaceutical pain medications, all prescribed by my
Opioids.
doctor.
Oh,
Yep,
yeah.
exactly,
It's an
exactly.
epidemic because of this horrible culture that we have of trying to kill
Yeah,
the pain. Yeah, in that way.
absolutely. And it was really before that was a nationally known awareness like it is now. And so it was, we're
Acceptable.
very much, yeah, it was very acceptable to follow this idea from, this is what your doctor's suggesting. So I went down a path with that. I didn't play for about 2 years. I was in a full like chest just below my breast to my over my hips back brace
Oh man.
for my junior year and half my senior year. And they actually released me to play again. I had healed to what they had, I identified, and I got into a hard tackle my Christmas tournament of my senior year, and some girl just laid me out, and I went to the hospital on a stretcher and the whole nine yards, and they were like, you're done. Like you can have back surgery, or you can be done playing, and there's other more homeopathic. And there was conversations of, this is a major back surgery, and I wasn't willing to have the risk of not being able to walk again. And
This
so
was the
my,
second time it happened? Oh my goodness.
yeah. So
It's a
the big,
sign.
yes,
You're not playing
exactly.
anymore. Oh, that's devastating though when it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't know, I didn't have any tools at that time, right? I mean, those developmental years are so confusing anyways. But where that addiction really kicked in for me was endish of my junior year. We lost a really good friend to meningitis, and it was very sudden. He was gone within a matter of one day.
Oh,
Basically,
geez.
he had just scored the winning goal for the boys soccer team to win state 2 weeks before. So the soccer community at my high school was, and even in my hometown, was very tight-knit. And so, as one does in high school, when you lose a friend, you have an honorary kegger, right? And for me, that was the first time that I mixed those pills with alcohol. And that was the, I have goosebumps. That was the first time I felt comfortable in my skin. That's the first time I wasn't crawling. That's the first time my brain, it's that first high that we hear about all the time in the
That
rooms.
was the fix.
That was it. And I chased that for 10 years. And of
Okay.
course, no amount of alcohol, no cocktail of anything else ever matched that first time.
No.
And so for me, that was at 15. I had drank a little bit and I had partied a little bit, but I knew I come from a family of alcoholics on my dad's side. So I knew intellectually to never get into hard drugs because I knew I had an addictive personality. But it was that moment that there was no turning back for me. I remember it was like it was yesterday. And I went on to chase it for another 10 years. And so I drank and I used the pills afterwards for quite some time. That was not my DOC, but it definitely, hit that first. It was a catalyst for sure. But I drank and did everything else under the sun that I could imagine. between the pills and cigarettes and men and all of these other things, all these other addictions, to try and feel that feeling again. And, you know, after 10 years, I could never find it again, but I had a code.
Okay.
There was one person who to me was like the epitome of an alcoholic. And it's like, as long as I'm never as bad as her,
oh yeah,
I'd be okay.
The comparing.
Until the one day I was.
Okay. So finally it escalated over time. And so what happened towards the end? How did you finally decide to surrender?
It was August 2nd. It was the day of my last drink. And I was actually at a family reunion. And I threw...
Is this person in your family?
What's that?
The person you were comparing yourself to.
Yep.
Okay. So she was at the party?
Yep.
And you were worse than she was? No.
I had this moment and jumping. We were sitting out by a fire pit. And I had two double tequilas in my hands at the fire pit, just, you know, ignoring everybody. And, you know, what's better than staring into a fire, you know, when you're an escapist, right? Mm-hmm. And I had this moment. I was never a blackout artist. I could count on probably one hand the times that I remember blacking out. And it was almost like I could watch myself go into it. And this moment, I was sitting at the fire and I looked across the fire at her. And I remember having some judgmental comment about how belligerent and obnoxious she was being. And I was just about to enter into this tequila infused blackout. And all I heard from inside myself was, "You're on her level."
Oh my.
And that was it. I woke up the next morning and my parents told me about the rest of my evening and the shenanigans that had happened at this schmancy resort that we were at. For this party. And I got in my car to go to work. There's no conscious conversation about it. I downloaded a sobriety tracker and I entered in the time as
really?
I was getting into my car. And I was on a fitness journey at this point. And so I had convinced myself the next logical step, because I had plateaued a little, was to eliminate alcohol. So that's what I told everybody I was doing for the first 30 days.
Which is easy. In case it didn't stick, you could,
because ego runs my life at this point. And I hit 30 days and I happened to open the app and I had hit 30 days and I had self-justified that I had deserved at this point now a case of wine to celebrate my accomplishments. And I was like, oh shit, I think I have a drinking problem. And so it really wasn't until 30 days after that I admitted to myself that I had a problem.
But did you remember nothing else from that night, but you remembered that little voice that said, "You are at her level"?
Okay. I remember everything up to it. And then that point, and then when I woke up out of the blackout the next morning and my parents were sitting at the bed next to me, we were sharing a hotel room, and nothing. But I remember that voice clear as day.
Gotcha. And were there any other sober people in your family at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there were. So you knew about sobriety. You knew about, okay, recovery, in other words. All right. So when did you then decide to start going to the program?
I actually didn't get into the rooms for a year and a half. I white knuckled it for a year and a half with no alcohol. I immediately replaced that with weight training and working out, which then transitioned into dancing and men and all of the other things.
So you took the plug out of the jug, but you stuck it into some other ways to escape. Well, that's pretty typical. But you did get physically, it sounds like, healthy. And then you finally started going for the mental wellness.
Yeah. And I couldn't figure out why I was crazy. I had this great body and I was totally in control over, you know, all of my life. And so for me, it was the religious thing. It was the God conversation. And I was like, I'm not.
Turned you off, you mean?
Yeah.
And oh, that's funny. And you consider yourself a spiritual teacher now, which I love.
Yeah. And, you know, to anybody who is, you know, I know your audience is primarily, you know, has time under their belt. But I would always say, you know, to a newcomer or somebody who's considering working a program, it's not a religious program. Mm-hmm. You don't have to believe in any particular form of God. And had I known that, And I knew it existed, but I had my own preconceived notion. I didn't have anybody who explained that to me until I got a job in LA and my boss was sober and one of my coworkers was his sponsee. So they arrived at my desk one day and they asked me, "Are you sober or you're not drinking?" So as we know in program, they're asking me, am I working a program or am I dry? But I didn't know that at the time. So
Right,
I
of
said
course.
sober. So they looked at each other and obviously it concluded, a conversation that I was not privy to. They handed me a blue book and they said, look for the similarities and not the differences. And I took it home and I started reading it and I got to the part that we talk about sex and I closed the book and I called him and I was like, yeah, okay, I'm an alcoholic. And he's like, cool, I'm going to pick you up at 7 in the morning and we're going to go to this 7:15 meeting.
Oh, that's
And
awesome.
that became my home group for many years. I met my sponsor that very first day. And she's still my sponsor today. She is very hardcore by the book, and she was exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be more grateful. And could I wish I got it sooner? Of course, but I got it when I was ready.
And how old were you when you got clean and sober?
25.
Okay, so that's
So
pretty young.
26 and a half-ish probably when I got into the rooms.
Yeah, super. That's fantastic. And those people, those connections that you make in those rooms. And now you have a boss and a colleague who also works the program that you can talk to. I mean, that accountability right there really helps to keep you sober. But what would you say is the key to your success for not going back or relapsing?
One day at a time. I'm a future tripper for sure. But it's ultimately the answer is my relationship with my higher power. I have nothing that I have today without my relationship with my higher power.
Yeah.
I didn't do this. I co-created. I had my part, but this is
Well,
all the work of a higher power for sure.
so did you feel a little bit like you were white knuckling it the whole first year and a half?
Oh
Okay.
gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And then serenity came to you, and when you started working the steps, and you got all of the promises that we talk about.
Yeah,
Okay.
absolutely. And to be fully transparent, I rode that pink cloud, that we hear about in the very beginning, but I didn't finish my first fourth step for almost 4 years
Oh.
because my life got really big and my program got really small.
Tell me about your life. What happened?
At the job with the sober boss, I got an opportunity from the girlfriend of my sober coworker to work event production in motorsports. So I was working with her in the off season, and I'm very organized, type A, independent. And so I was helping her with all this organizational administrative work, having no idea what I was doing. And then it what I was actually doing was receiving sponsor deliverables for these race teams. And so when spring came around and race season starts to, kind of come out of hibernation, there was the first event in Texas. And she asked me if I wanted to go. And I was like, sure. And I got the time off work and I fell in love. And she offered me a job and I went in and I put in my 2 weeks and I went on the road.
Nice.
I had been
So,
working with my sponsor for like maybe 2 months.
oh my goodness. And then you just got right into this career work, which in I'm thinking is a lot of schmoozing and boozing going on in
After
that whole.
parties, after every event, you name it. So we had to learn how to stay sober on the road. My sponsor and I had to learn how to have this long distance relationship. It was very unconventional for sure. I
But you did it.
did it by the
So
grace
your
of God.
life got really big, and then what happened? It's not, when did you become like a Reiki master and decide to get into spiritual growth and development?
I truly hit my bottom about halfway through 2018, and I had 3 businesses. I was living bicoastally. I had this big, beautiful life. And I was suicidal. I truly had my darkest dark in sobriety.
Yeah, so you turn to workaholism and other sort of things to
100%
not feel your feelings, and you kept stuffing stuff. That's what I'm guessing.
100% Yeah, absolutely.
You were still being a good girl, Morgan.
Yeah.
And getting those, you know, the praise from people and everybody patting you on the back. Look how great you're doing. But meanwhile, you're suffering inside. So what happened with that spiritual collapse, so to speak? You said you've contemplated suicide.
I had grown up with some anxiety and depression, and so I was no stranger to what those thoughts looked like. And so I had at this point a mental health team that I had worked with, you know, for many years. I had seen a Reiki practitioner for probably about 5 years at this point, since 2013. And so I had actively started putting together this team around me, now realizing that, you know, what a God shot that was, because at this moment I knew the phone call to make, right? That 100-pound phone call that we hear about in the program a lot, it was straight to my mental health team. And I heard what came out of my mouth, and I was like, okay, I'm willing to go to get some help. And that was one thing my sponsor always told me from the beginning was, you know, sometimes we need outside help. And I heard her, but that was the point when I understood, and I was like, okay, I'm willing and I need some outside help. So I had some pretty intense outside help for 5 or 6 months. And then I woke up one day out of a dead sleep, and I knew the next indicated action. And I called my business partner and I resigned, and he accepted my resignation on the spot, which was a huge blow to my ego.
Oh,
he did not fight for me or anything. He just let me go.
I thought you were going to say because he cared and he knew I needed space. No. Okay. Wow.
And so for me, that was really the turning point. And that's when I really got to work. And I really think that that's when I started having those true spiritual experiences where the promises are delivered. You know, and this is many years into sobriety, but I have no problem talking about that because it's not the same journey for everybody. You know, would I always recommend getting into the steps as soon as possible? Absolutely. You know, but it takes what it takes, and it's, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And I was the sometimes slowly variety. And, but when I really started to get into doing that work is when those spiritual experiences and those promises really started to happen for me, and all of the big shiny things left. But this peace and serenity and this service work, all of these things that are really velvety, juicy goodness of life, I really started to understand at that point. So that's really when the spiritual work started for me. And so I had the opportunity. I really don't even remember how it crossed my plate, but I had an opportunity to become certified in Reiki, which I had been a practitioner or a recipient of for many, many years. And I was like, yeah, I'd absolutely love to be able to do this for myself. I had no intention of it becoming a career or part of my career at all. And then I continued on with the levels, and within no time was a Reiki master, having these huge spiritual transformations and being able to do this work for others. And then COVID hit, when everybody could use a little extra energy work
right
at this point, right?
Yeah.
And so what I did was, in Reiki, which I know you're familiar with, but maybe for your audience, is one of the levels of early Reiki certification is being able to do distance healing.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be in person. And so as the whole world is transitioning virtually, I started hosting once a week free Reiki circles. And so it was a free donation-based service, and I would gather on Zoom, and it started to become a thing. And so these guided meditations started pouring out of me. I had no idea that I had this voice for guided meditations. And luckily at some point, you know, I had the knowing to push record on Zoom, and I have this library of beautiful meditations.
Oh.
And so that really was what the feedback was that I got, was like, wow, you really have a gift for this. And so it transitioned more from one-on-one work to creating these meditations, and, you know, of Tony Robbins' work and these sorts of things about, the knowledge industry, online courses. So I really started packaging all of these meditations, and I've done a lot of work with Tony Robbins and this work on the self-knowledge industry, creating online courses and packaging my knowledge for others. And so that's when the pivot really happened in my business. So I was seeing less and less one-on-one clients and more gearing towards this. I had this new love for group classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, COVID was a huge blessing. I love to say that this experience is either was completely ruined your life, or you saw it as the opportunity to make the pivot that a lot of us needed.
Yeah.
And I really, really pivoted.
That's so cool.
So I feel like I catapulted this tenfold. It maybe would have taken 5 years to get to this point in my business that I'm in, but I really leaned into that pivot, and it's, been an incredible journey in a short amount of time.
I went to that Tony Robbins program too, at the beginning of COVID, where, it's like, okay, you guys, we got whatever, 4 weeks, you're going to make it big, and here's how you do it. That was so motivating. Is that one of the things you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah. And there's some great teachers out there to really help mm-hmm. you with digital online courses. I created mine during COVID as well. It's called Recovery at Work. And we do a lot of the same stuff, you and I, although I do training for groups, but I really like coaching one-on-one, because then you can dig deep into mm-hmm. into the stuff. But also it is cool in a group, because then everybody gets the benefit of hearing, if somebody's willing to talk about like their conditioning and how to redo an old
Absolutely.
Belief, everybody gets benefit from that stuff. So that's great. So tell us a little bit about your book, Morgan, and then I'm going to ask you for what advice you have for people who are just starting out in sobriety, but want to step into leadership. But first, tell us about your book.
So my book is part memoir, part self-help. I've broken it down into three parts, which is part one, the conditioning, part two is the crumbling, and part three is the phoenix.
Oh, that's perfect. I love it. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
So really sharing my experience, strength, and hope, because one thing I've learned from the rooms is that when I share my story and I'm vulnerable, that there's that opportunity for someone to attach on and be like, me too. That's the point of willingness. So I could have put out a teaching voice self-help book, sure, but you have to be willing to digest that. And so for me, I chose to go this route of sharing my story. One is an exercise of sharing my voice, which is something that I had not been great at. And so I had started a podcast, and it was kind of this evolution of working with my own coaches about expressing my voice. But the more I got into it, I was like, this is my vulnerability, so that someone else can attach to that me too moment. And then maybe that is the trigger or the catalyst for them to look at themselves. So really my intention is to hold up a mirror and allow, each of the readers to begin to look at their life. And so each part has self-reflection opportunities, which are like journal prompts. Mm-hmm. And, you can really start to identify as you get through the book where you fall in your journey.
Okay. That's great. Congratulations.
And it's called Unravel the Bullshit.
Unravel the Bullshit. Yeah, I like your title. That's good. My book is called Emerge. And I talk about 7 steps to transformation, but it always starts with going back to unravel the bullshit first. You got to mm-hmm. do that. And then really learn to work with your energy and mm-hmm. learn how to manifest. And then mm-hmm. finally creating a plan and stepping into that new identity. But you said those three words. How did you describe them again? One was crumble, and then phoenix.
The conditioning, the crumbling, and the phoenix.
Okay. So mine is that I sort of relate to that is my podcast name is Emerge, Evolve, and then Lead. And it's the same sort of thing. Like that emerging Amazing. Is really looking at what are you conditioned to be doing and becoming aware and conscious and a little bit more enlightened. And then evolving, you got to look deep within and stop trying to figure out what you want on the outside, but what you want on the inside. And then finally developing others, right? Because you got to develop yourself first, then develop others. So I love the process. That's so good. So if you were, when you come across somebody who, say, has 5 years of sobriety and is getting ready to step into leadership, what advice would you give them?
I would say really take these primary principles, you know, that we're given. And for me, it's in terms of leadership, that would be this compassion and judgment-free space holding, really. You know, I personally had so much judgment. And in recovery, I've learned, like, no. Who am I?
We really have no right to judge anyone because we have no idea what the hell they've been through.
No, right? Not at all. And yeah. And some of my nearest and dear to my heart, had I known them prior to recovery, I would have hugely judged them, but they've done the work. And so one thing I think that it's a very common misconception is that people can't change.
Oh, I totally
total
agree.
Bullshit.
Total bullshit. And if you're in the corporate environment, they talk about it all the time. I was in HR for years and people behind closed doors, especially, you know, supervisors talking about their people. Oh, that's he'll never change. People don't change. It really is a belief that a lot of people in business have, and it's wrong. I'm like, that's BS. I know for a fact. I've seen thousands of people completely change. But 100%. It does take work and it does take a shift, right?
Yeah.
And that's the miracle of life.
Absolutely.
It can happen overnight or sometimes it just takes a lifetime.
Absolutely. And so I would say that removing the judgment, you know, that's going to separate you from being a great leader, hands down. I would say the other thing is a willingness to listen.
Mm.
Most people truly just want to be seen and understood.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can show up with your people or your team or whatever the, you know, the dynamic looks like, and you can learn how to hold space for people, whatever it is that they're going through, you don't have to solve their problems.
Nope.
But if you can just hold space and listen, people usually get to the result by just talking to themselves,
yeah.
You know, hearing it themselves. Most people will get to something or they just need the release. And
yeah.
So I would say that
they need
those
a witness.
And to not be judged on the other side of that really resolves so much interpersonal conflict, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I would say to be a great leader is that ability to listen and hold space for people. Like, listen more than you talk.
It's a good, very, very good advice. I've heard it before and it's definitely bears repeating and people get it. It because everyone wants to be heard.
And those are the people who are going to show up for you time and time again, are those people who feel understood and that you care.
They're going to be loyal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is going to in turn allow you to continue growing as a leader.
Yeah, absolutely. Morgan, that was awesome. Thank you so much. I'm so glad for everybody to hear your story and where you've come to. Tell us, how can people get in touch with you?
I am on all of the social medias. My primary is on Instagram. My handle is @MorganChonis or @UnravelTheBullshit. And from there, you can link to all of my other channels. My website's MorganChonis.com. I'm very easy to find.
Awesome.
And thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. I'm glad we met. We have similar personalities, similar mission, and that is we got to keep shining the light, man, and show all these other people that you don't have to be escaping with substances or any other thing that you might be addicted to, because life really is delicious, as you say, when you get into that. So thanks again for coming on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. You can visit us at EmergeLeadershipAcademy.com to take the quiz to find out what animal best represents your leadership style. And until next week, remember, you have so many leadership skills that you learn in recovery. Stop hiding because your contribution matters.